Okay. We wanted to have a panel discussion. You're going to really drive this with your questions, okay? But anything we'd like to focus on what we've been teaching on this week. So anything that you would like to comment about or have us discuss further? Yes.
Thank you.
It's not an aspersion.
Oh, okay. And this isn't hyssop. So anyway, the question was a very good one. It deals with, to some extent, McLuhan's point about the medium is the message, and also I think was dealing with the issue of how we take these ancient truths, looking at past conferences where there's been a mention of form. Well, just to give you an idea, the setting I'm currently in, I'm doing some supply work, which is a whole new thing for me as a bishop, but tomorrow I will be singing a solemn high mass with where you can barely see the altar with the incense, and I will be doing the asperges, and that will end with the Angelus at the end. So that gives you an idea that I'm at a place currently where the form is extremely important. It's also, for those of you familiar with it, the American Missal, which is 28 with all the additions. So that's the way I was brought up. And that's what my diocese in Quincy is very similar to that. But so obviously, I just start out by saying the form is extremely important to me. But I want to go on to say that that was the whole issue that the Tractarian movement and the Oxford movement had to deal with. That is, the impetus for the Oxford movement was not a purely theological, nor was it a liturgical renewal. It was actually the problem we deal with today. There are people coming to me saying, how can we be renewed? And I usually say to them something like, you can't be renewed if you haven't been nude. So we've got to get to the rudimentary and get people nude before we can talk about being renewed. Well, the political situation in the Oxford movement was dealing with a changing some of the Irish sees, that is, where the bishops were. And that resulted in this whole sermon and this whole concern that's articulated in the sermon, national apostasy. What happened, though, was when they started looking at the premise that the Church of England was nothing other than the continuation of the Catholic Church that had always existed there, it sparked all sorts of questions about what does it mean to function like that. The irony was that the most of that ministry was done in a rundown, unemployed, difficult section, the London docks and other places like that. And that's where the birth of much of the Oxford movement took place, not in the beautiful halls of Oxford, so to speak, or Cambridge. So it shows us, once again, the relationship between theology and catechesis. Theology was being worked out among the Tractarians, but in the parish ministry, it was catechesis. It was being played out in a catechetical way. Now, to pick up on the point, here's what I would want to say, that for those of us of the Catholic tradition, there would be all of us, we believe that the sacraments are portable. And the way to look at it would be to ask the question, how many healings did Jesus do in the synagogue? How many healings did Jesus do in the temple? How many healings did he do in the streets? Yeah. See, that's the answer, isn't it? So, the form is important, but here's the way it works. If the altar is the focal point of our ministry, then what we do is we take everything from the altar into the streets, and we bring everything from the streets to the altar. So the connection between, as one book says, earth and altar is a fascinating one to ponder, it seems to me. Are the forms important? Only if we think that the people that we're ministering to are worth it. That is, if I'm willing to treat people as if they really are sons and daughters of the king, and thus their royalty, then I'm going to worship the king with as much as I possibly can. This is not a churchmanship issue. I'm so bored of talking about churchmanship that it makes me doze. But the point being that if you treat people as if they are children of God, then that means by right you're going to worship their Heavenly Father with the enthusiasm and the best you can possibly offer. I'll conclude by just saying this, that what I do find interesting is how I'll discover people want their churches stripped down, and then I'll go into their houses and they have junk all over the walls. And I've never really figured out that if I went to a church that was stripped down, then I would assume I could go into their houses and they'd be stripped down too for the consistency. And so what happened is the Oxford movement started putting pictures on the walls in the houses of the people and in the houses of God.
Okay. Thank you. Other thoughts, questions? Okay, wait, they're bringing a mic. We capture an important question.
Okay. It's really a commentary on the entire catechetical session throughout this entire time. I find it interesting how all of this catechesis, and I mentioned it in Father Erlinson's workshop, it's very familial. Because as somebody, one of you mentioned, God the Father, the Church is the Mother, and you catechize the children, the people of God, into the family. And really it's a reflection on how the Christian family is to work. And it's fascinating to watch all of this come together, as, you know, because you catechize your children and you catechize the children of God. And I thought was a very interesting correlation. So
that's a great insight. And I wanted to make this, gives me an opportunity to make a point that I'd like to bring out. The people of God is the model family. And what you find happening in our culture is a perverted concept of family that has emerged. So that the church, once again, is a counterculture. We are now countercultural. The church used to be the culture of Western civilization. Not that everybody was a Christian, but generally the church was the culture. They just faced a big battle in Steubenville, where the Steubenville University, a very strong Catholic center there, because the pictures of the city that they had on brochures down in City Hall. You look across the landscape of the city, and there are skyscrapers, and there's a big steeple with a cross coming up. Well, they were opposed, and they had a battle, and they lost. So now they've had to change the landscape on the brochures of Steubenville, with a very strong Catholic concentration there, which is just one small / big example of what we are dealing with. But what it means is we are now, we have to operate as counterculture and recognize that we hold the deposit of what the true family is, as the family of God, and as families that comprise the family of God. So, and that fits in with what we're saying about the catechumenate, because you've heard Father Lee say a number of times through the week, it's not just a catechism. It is a whole sacramental culture, and it's now a counterculture. Not that we're against culture; it's just that we are being opposed by demonic forces that have recaptured Western civilization. And so, you know, there'll come a better day because Christ is Lord. But right now we have to operate that way, and that's why this catechumenate concept and practice, we call it community, but I like to speak of it as, you know, a sacramental culture. Because the word culture, I mean, the word community doesn't have anything to do with worship. The word culture comes from the word cultus, which means to worship. To worship. And culture, the Christian view of culture, is society organized around the altar of God.
There's a couple things on this that I didn't get to talk about yesterday, but would love to, and thanks for the opportunity. One is that people misunderstand catechesis when they think about it as merely transmission of information. It's actually culture making. What you're doing is building a culture. And that is an essential activity, but I think the thing that we often miss is that cultures are not built merely on rational information. They're built on practices. They're built on liturgies. They're built on whole ways of doing things, and that includes all kinds of education. So, for instance, I was telling somebody earlier, the family in the pew that is showing their children how to worship is building that culture in their children. It's not an inconsequential activity. And this is part of the problem with a rationalistic mindset where we say, well, that doesn't matter. So let's haul the kids out and let's put them in some other place where we can meet them on their level rationally, which is an impossible act. And then we'll bring them into the big culture. That's the only time when we ever think that we can teach children a culture outside of the normal means. And it's just one example. But culture making is catechesis. It's building a culture of faith within the church and bringing up generation after generation after generation in that culture. And it includes art, and it includes music, and it includes food, and it includes every facet of life. And that's one of the problems with modern cultures. We compartmentalize life to the point where now, you know, for instance, I don't want to pick on him, but the Obama administration says things like, you have the right to worship, but the rest of your life is fair game for our interference. Well, we have to stand against that because, and this is one of the problems with saying, well, you know, it doesn't matter about all that other stuff, just what matters is what happens inside the church. Well, do you not get it? The culture of faith influences all parts of life, and nothing can be untouched. But most American churches don't operate on that principle. They only see it as a matter of changing minds, if they see that at all. So do you see the point? Is that, and we have to be countercultural in positively every way, and that's a real challenge. So, but that's a catechetical enterprise. Okay.
I know that myself and with others here are about to go off to higher education, going to college. And I've had the opportunity to hear catechesis in the parish, catechesis in the parish school, catechesis in the family. And I'd like to ask for guidance, comments on catechesis in higher education for those of us going into it.
Good question. Very, very good question. And I think where I'd start is you're pointing out that the catechumenate is lifelong. Because in a sense, our whole life in this life is preparation for the world to come. And, we're to sanctify and grow in grace all our life. And just parenthetically, I'd say, a lot of us who've ministered in liturgical churches, let's say, there is an unfortunate, oftentimes, mindset that once you get confirmed, then you stop learning. Whereas confirmation is really just the next step to the fuller life of learning. The old Thomistic, it's why you get the slap on the cheek from the bishop. you know, because you're now in God's army. The war is really just beginning, you know. So you're going off to university. Needs to be undergirded in the continued catechumenate for you. It means finding a solid church. This sacramental culture, you know, that I was talking about, so that the catechumenate it can continue, even more so, because you're gonna be bombarded with so much contrary. You know, I remember Francis Schaeffer in, you know, the last century, he once described reading philosophy as holding your nose and swimming underwater, you know, because most of us aren't trained very well to do that. But I think he was saying, you know, look, you just, this is really hard stuff, and so many ideas coming at you that cut against your underpinnings. So I would just say, find a solid church, continue the catechumenate.
Let me just say, I'm guessing you're going to the greatest university on the planet. Well, you're in luck, because a number of Anglican students at A&M have founded an Anglican student group, and I'll get you in touch with it. But this is one example of a practical way. These students went and they found we can't go to these churches. We just can't do it. I was in the same position when I was there. And what they've done is they get together for breakfast once a week, lunch once a week. They have weeknight meetings. They have a Bible study. And get this, they've now got priests from the Diocese of Fort Worth driving down to College Station to minister to them once a month. I think it's even getting to be once every 2 weeks now. But do you see what they're doing? They're forming communities, and they're doing it instinctively. And part of my point there is that someday that group will become a parish. One of the great things that happened in the Presbyterian Church of America is they started these student groups that ultimately became churches. And the reason was that they were very intentional about catechesis within those groups. And they wound up bringing lots of people into that group. They're very porous. And so I'd encourage anybody that's in college, find other students who you can form those communities with and call upon the church to help you in that. And in whatever way you ask for, because nobody will say no. We'll say, when do I get to be there? Invite them and do that. What we find is that college students are the most entrepreneurial, church planting minded people in the whole church. Why? Well, contrary to popular belief, they have unlimited amounts of free time. But they're also so intent upon building community in a way that no one else can be. So keep that in mind that you know you might go to college to plant an Anglican church. You might wind up just doing it, but it's almost easy actually. Because of where you are, right? So I just keep that in mind, and I'll hook you up with the people, and you'll have a good time.
Thank you. One of the things that I started doing was I did not intentionally start writing books and doing teaching DVDs. That was not something I just wanted to do. But as I started traveling around the country and college campuses and other intentional communities, people would ask questions like, why isn't there anything written on X? Why are there no teaching DVDs on Y? And so everything we have over there, for example, is a result of inquiries that people had and saying, we need to have more about such and such. So I'm asking all of you to help me with that. If you think there's not a teaching DVD or a CD on a particular subject, let me know. But that leads me to the point is that I think that when people go to university, they need to be living a rule of life. And before you go off to university, you need to sit down with your priest and help develop a rule of life that you can take with you. And then one of the first things you do when you get there at the university is not figure out who your counselor is going to be or who's going to help you set up your curriculum, but get a spiritual director. So the second thing is to have a spiritual director. And by having, therefore, a rule of life and a spiritual director, that means you'll be in a position to constantly have that touch point. The one book over there called The Lifetime Road to God, Lifetime Road to God, written by a well-known scholar and bishop, Bishop Donald J. Parsons, doesn't need an introduction to most of you, but over there, Lifetime Road to God, it deals with how you live the Christian life in a world, as Bishop Sutton has said, where we have to be countercultural. A rule of life is countercultural because it means I have determined that I am going to do this in the midst of my chaotic life so that I can serve Jesus. Put it a little differently. Oftentimes, many people in university are in the receiving mode, receiving information, receiving all sorts of stimuli, as it were, whereas we need to be engaged in also putting out, giving out, through ministry. And so rule of life helps us do ministry. Why? Because ultimately all prayer is supposed to be head, heart, and hands. Head, heart, and hands. We pray and we're informed. It lights up our heart, and then as a result of that, it makes us do something. If you live rule of life, you will be engaged in the head, heart, and hands.
Thank you. Just come back to the question, kind of bring this together. I would say we have a number of college students here. To capture what Father Leah said, if you go to your campus and you find a group that is like-minded, and probably you're going to have a hard time finding a church where all your campuses are, you have bishops here. You know us as bishops, and if you will contact us, we know where all the bishops are in ACNA, the Anglican Church in North America, and all the jurisdictions within it. We can try to get you a priest, connect you with a bishop who'll find you a priest. If it's in this part of the country, I mean, we know where some priests are who might come down to your campus maybe, you know, once a month, or we get a group of priests worked out to cover that campus. We can have a priest there every Sunday, you know, to do a Eucharist for you. And we'll do that because we realize we're in that mission situation. And this could be the birth of a whole new student movement around this concept. So I hope you'll run with it. But you must, as Father Leah said, you really must find the faithful and stay in church and the Word and the Sacrament. You really must. We'll get the clergy to you. We'll figure out a way. Okay? Good questions. Yeah. Question back here, or over here first.
Sorry, Nicole. Bishop Sutton, in your first lecture, the first plenary, you talked about acquiring the mind of Christ and therefore the mind of the undivided church. Well, that idea is pretty foreign in a post-Enlightenment age, and I was wanting to ask, what can parishes and parents do to combat the worldview that says that it's my faith, my theology, my philosophy, my ideas? And how do we create that intellectual humility that's required to, as you said, present our bodies and minds to the singular mind of the undivided church?
Good question. I'm doing from my class. I'm doing a new book on the covenant, the biblical covenant, as an incarnational covenant. And on the biblical side, that'll help. So stay tuned for that. But I think for us as Anglicans, it's recapturing really what we have always been about. And for those of us who've come through the Reformation, recognizing that the English Reformation was trying to recapture the undivided church, get back to the undivided church in its theology, its practice, in its everything. I would say there's an English scholar, Arthur Middleton, who's written an excellent book on restoring the Anglican mind. We talked among the clergy. I'm trying to just work out the scheduling, but he has committed to be a speaker for us, not next year, but the year after at Anglican Way. And we're just trying to get the dates worked out. But his book, Restoring the Anglican Mind, is absolutely essential. More than anything, just teaching in the congregation that our model, our standard, is the undivided church. And what it means to be part of the church, that we're, well, it's analogous to the Holy Trinity, as the Holy Trinity is one and many. So we have a individual and corporate aspect to the church. But the problem, as you've pointed out, is that the individual has totally trumped the corporate. We confess in the creed this wonderful statement, the communion of the saints. I think probably a great deal of work needs to be done on what it means that we confess the communion of the saints. You know, that's not just all the Christians alive right now. That's the one holy Catholic and apostolic church of all ages.
I was more, and this might be connected, but in terms of higher education, dealing with not necessarily doctrinal issues within the church ecumenically, but dealing with issues outside, ideas outside, and even science and things like this, creating that trust in the teaching of the church. I don't know if that could be spoken to.
I think that's why the historic processes of initiation, for example, that Father Lee talked about, how we come into the church being catechized and taught. Now, I've often put it this way. I think many Christians in recent years, that they're born with many, I call them spiritual birth defects, if you will. I mean, if I could put it that way, because of the weird way they've been discipled. They were formed the wrong way from the beginning. And of course, now as they come into our churches, we have to re-form the curing of that soul. But it means trying to overcome enormous spiritual birth defects, and you're mentioning one of them. That it's me, it's all about me, and I. And of course, what I tried to bring out in my first talk was, I mean, you read the New Testament, and you have to step away from trying to read the New Testament just as an individual. I mean, certainly it applies to you as an individual, but through the church. I mean, it was written; these letters were written to the church, you know. And we take the you plurals in the New Testament, and we run them through this hyper individualism of Western, you know, civilization. Well, I think what Father Lee was saying, that when people come into our churches, they need to be immersed in a new member catechetical program. To re-hyphen form them.
I just have one comment. A lot of people just need to be told to shut up and listen. I'm serious. Because we entertain way too much questioning within catechesis. We need to just say, this is the faith. And that's it. If you don't like it, there are lots of churches in town. But we have entertained this idea that people who disagree can sort of be allowed to get by in some relative amount of peace. But, you know, there are essentials that we've been talking about all this time. And I've had to be in that position, unfortunately, sitting there in catechesis classes and having a guy argue with me. I mean, I had a heckler for a whole year of catechesis. He was a Baptist guy. And I basically just told him, that's not the case. Here's what the undivided church teaches. If you don't like that, if you don't agree with it, I don't know what to tell you. But the Christian faith is not yours, and it's not mine. It's ours. And we got it from them. Who got it from him. And that's it. So if you don't like it, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, and I think a lot of that is just, you know, you need to shut up and listen. Because we have this idea that we can riff on the Christian faith. That we can just sort of play something that sounds like it, but it's not it. Does that make sense? So a lot of that is just, a lot of that is clergy exercising authority, which is something that we just don't like in our culture, so we don't do it. But we need to do it. So I just say that. And encourage your clergy to do that. I mean, if you hear them and they say, well, a lot of people say this, a lot of people say this, say, Father, we want you to give us the truth. And no more, no less. And that's encouragement to us, because a lot of times we get timid, and we don't need to be, especially about essentials.
Yeah, I would just say that this underscores why standing on the shoulders of the undivided church is so important. I mean, there have been lots of novel ideas theologically that emerged, you know, after the undivided church. But we can't embrace them dogmatically. But we can, you know, what's been already decided upon by the whole church everywhere at all times. I mean, my big concern with, you know, people, individual groups that write confessions of faith, you know, they're forever dying 1,000 deaths, you know, because they try to make dogmatic what the church has not, just their little part of the church has. And, of course, it just fragments. Wow, I see lots of hands flowing now.
I think this is primarily just on Father Nelson and Bishop Ackerman's talks. It seems like it's been very well expounded, the catechesis of the unchurched and how we go about that. And I'm just wondering about the church practicalities of catechesis for the family. So they're baptized as infants. They receive, you know, they're exercised. They receive the chrism. And so as a subset of that, if one of you could touch on the historicity of joining baptism and confirmation at the infant stage, and if that is consistent with kind of what you guys are saying, or if there should be a catechesis from the church for the churched children leading up to confirmation, and just kind of touch on the historicity and that sort of thing. He's laughing. That's not good.
Well, although I don't always like referring to it as Christian initiation, only because it can be trivialized, if one looks very, very carefully at the historical development of the rites of initiation, we discover a couple of realities. First of all, from what we could determine, there was a unified rite. That is to say, at baptism, one received the water rite. They received the rite, the various oil rites, too, at least in one place, one usage or three, but two, and then receiving the body and blood of Christ. And so all of it was done in a unified way. We have to also remember, though, that the rites of initiation for children, as you heard Father Nelson say so well, were done for children of Christians. And therefore, the question was, is it appropriate to baptize the children of Christian adults who will raise them in the faith? And we've talked a little bit about that. But your question touches on something a little bit deeper. And it is interesting, isn't it, that we talk about the great dominical sacraments. We talk about the two ordained by Christ, however one phrases in whichever document you're reading. And those are the two over which there seems to be the greatest disagreement, doesn't it? I mean, disagreement over the Eucharist, what happens, when it happens, etc. And baptism, who, when, how, all of those have been questions that seem to divide Christians. But there is inherent in all of the questions that are asked at baptism, if one looks carefully at the apostolic constitutions, Hippolytus, if one looks at the Didache, if one reads the works of Justin Martyr, it becomes very clear that this lifelong process of catechizing is a familial reality. And it, without my sounding horribly cynical, I oftentimes find it's an easy way out when people plan mission trips and go overseas to do missions and they've never catechized their own family. They're always coming up with a new mission plan to go plant something here or give money over there, and they have cousins and aunts and uncles and parents and children who don't know Jesus Christ. There's a certain Christian arrogance in my mind when we don't do that. I wish some Christians who are hopped up about doing mission work could take a year off and evangelize their own families. And I think then if that would happen, maybe we might be able to see a greater credibility. I think that what the Eastern Rites do is historically correct. I'm convinced what the Eastern Rites do is absolutely historically defensible and correct, and I would fight for that. On the other hand, I see a practical reality in the culture in which we live. I could talk about the Ambrosian usage, and I could talk about the Rites of Milan and tell you what they had in mind when they deferred confirmation until the bishop came. I mean, there's all sorts of arguments to support that. I could even talk a little bit about what Cranmer had in mind and what the reforming cardinal Quiones had in mind when he was talking about how confirmation could be appropriately done when they were debating that in the 16th century. But it does not take away from the cultural reality that there has to be not only ongoing catechesis, but there are rites of passage whether we like it or not. In the American culture, the rites of passage means the handing over the car keys. That is a rite of passage. It's an expectation that a 16-year-old has, and it's also that an expectation that the Geico man has. It all kind of goes very well together. That's where they make all their money, is exactly right. So I find myself in a position of wanting to argue what ought to be done if we were a Christian culture, namely the complete and total unification of the rites, versus what I see as practical in a situation that is not a Christian culture. And yet I would not get to the silliness of a House of Bishops meeting in 1973 when this was being proposed by Father Benel Spencer, Order of the Holy Cross, that the rites of initiation be brought together and that it wouldn't be necessary for bishops to do confirmation. That could be done by the priest, who would be delegated to do so, a la the Eastern Rites. And one bishop stood up and said, well, what would be left for us bishops to do? Which was a very good commentary on what bishops were not doing. They'd become confirmation machines rather than pastors of the pastors, and as defenders of the faith and disseminators of the faith. So I'm not as nervous about confirmation being caught up with the bishop as I am the church reclaiming confirmation as a reality that has to occur. And that takes us back to your question about the family. That's the reason I'm convinced that there has to be a curricula available for families. What I wish is that every week the church would lay out the theme, and it would be the expectation that people took that information home. They worked on it as a family. Then they came back to the church the following week to talk about what they had accomplished in the course of the week. Somebody raised an interesting question yesterday. They said, using your neo-Mormonism model that you've been talking about, why don't you become bold enough to proclaim that there ought to be one night a week when the family says that it must stay at home and be together as a family, which is what the Mormons require? And I said, yeah, they also require that everybody tithe, and I'd be interested in looking at both of those.
I want to echo what you said about, you know, there is a practical reason to do confirmation later, and I would say that, yes, it's very, very pastoral in that sense. Keeping in mind that, you know, I do and I will maintain that baptism of infants is a dispensation that we give because of the faith of the parents. With that in mind, do we have to absolutely require that every parent either have gone through some sort of catechumenate personally, which I require now, and by the way, have seen three adult baptisms so far just from that in 4 years. And it's just incredibly powerful. And those parents take that responsibility seriously. The other thing that I would say as well is that we have to encourage our bishops to rethink how they do confirmation. Because again, a lot of them show up, they kind of swoop down, they lay hands on a few people, and they take off. My new bishop is absolutely amazing when it comes to this. He showed up Saturday at about 2:00 in the afternoon, demanding that he spend 2 hours with all those to be confirmed, received, and the rest. Demanding. There was no question. He spent 2 hours catechizing them, getting to know them on a one-to-one basis. And then the next day, before he confirmed each one, he took their hands in his and he prayed for them by name. He didn't have to have a name tag to know who they were. He just took their hands and he prayed for them. And then he confirmed them. And there's a lot to be said for bishops regaining their role as chief catechists. Our bishops today are administrators. They are, in a very few cases, not parish. They're in most cases not parish priests, and they need to be more often, I think. But they need, above all those practical questions, they need to regain their place as the chief catechists. And that happens in two ways. The first is that they teach when they show up in a parish, and not merely preach, but teach as well, and that they also have an ongoing teaching ministry with their clergy, which I'm glad to see Bishop Sutton embodies here in a very unique way. But bishops have given that up, but they need to regain it. They need to sit down with their clergy regularly and just hold court. And that, you know, that was what Augustine did. He was the director of a catechetical school. I mean, he held court all the time. Bishops had households, and you joined the household, and that was how you prepared for ordination. You know, I love seminaries, but they need to get back to that kind of way of doing things. I've been reading Dietrich Bonhoeffer's biography, and he did that. He just gathered these young guys around him. They lived together, and he just taught them. They prayed together. He gave them meditations to do. That sounds like a wonderful way to go to seminary, by the way. But do you see that even though he wasn't a bishop, he took on that role of teaching his clergy, and he took it very seriously. And bishops need to be given the freedom to be able to do that. And I don't think we can quite think about how to do that yet, especially in this really spread out kind of culture. We probably need more bishops. I hate to say that.
um, I don't know if you've seen, you know, in the RE Church, we've got a catechism for children. I don't know if you've seen that. We're working on that. Of course, you know, Father Lee's really important work with ACNA. I think you're going to see more catechetical material coming forth. But picking up on something Father Lee said, I mean, the use of the question in the catechism, which is a very biblical model, and the basis for logic, really. But it is the teaching method of Scripture. I mean, it was so much the teaching method, you know, among the rabbis of Second Temple Judaism, that they typically answered a question with a question. I mean, that's why so many times in the Gospels you get Jesus, you know, answering a question with a question. That was a teaching method, because it's provocative. It brings out, it ultimately brings the mind to what Scripture calls chokmah, wisdom. Because you have to think. So we're working on the materials. There's a dearth of them, I know, right now. I mean, we've been talking about educational, adult educational materials, the need for that, you know, in our various teaching ministries, whether they're, you know, adult venues, home Bible studies or whatever. You know, I think that's why Bishop Ackerman's publishing company back there is, you know, it's very important. It's bringing materials, you know, that you're not going to get anywhere else, but can be used in that adult educational venue, and then you can take it and break it down. You know, I mean, they're getting ready to bring back a work. I don't know if you told them about Charles Grafton, who did this work on the Vincentian canon. Charles Grafton he is one of the most important Anglican bishops in the history of this country. In the 19th century, he was the one who spent all this time with Saint Tikhon. Now, he wasn't sainted at the time, but he was sainted after he was martyred shortly after the Bolshevik Revolution. So he went back and became patriarch. But it was Bishop Grafton at Nashota House who developed the relationship. But they saw all this. I mean, they if you read them, they were saying, what, like, they could sit here today, you know, and answer your questions. I mean, they anticipated all this. But with that, they saw the need for teaching. And so Bishop Grafton produced, really, I hope to see all of his writings back in print, but particularly his profound work on the Vincentian canon, you know, which gets back to the question about the undivided church. That is the canon of the undivided church, what was believed everywhere at all times by all. You know, there's an older catechism, it's Theophilus Anglicanus, that was used in English schools. I mean, so I think you'll eventually see all this kind of material come back in print as we're able to do it. But you in your families, you'll have to do homeschool education in your families in terms of the catechism. And that really is, that's the foundation for it all in the church.
If I could just say that what's exciting for me about this week is you're asking me questions and talking with me about things that I didn't think anybody wanted to talk about anymore. I mean, there are days when I walk around thinking that I'm a stranger in a strange land, because my training, my education, my experience, my interests don't seem to correspond with most of the places that I find myself. And certainly that has been the case in certain settings that I won't mention. But this week, I have found you engaging me in areas that I have particular interest, asking questions of me that allow me to be able to use some gifts that God has given me. But the other thing is, it gives me an opportunity to become a little more energized about what I'm going to be working on with Parish Press.
I mean, I didn't have time to think about that when I was a diocesan bishop, but one of the things that I can do now is to get you ready to use items, but I'm going to be counting on you again to say, we need something on the subject of A, we need more on this, please do this, we'll do it, we'll get it done. And I appreciate Bishop Sutton mentioning that. Bishop Grafton, talk about exciting. You heard what Father Nelson was saying about bishops teaching. I hardly ever stood in the pulpit in the Diocese of Quincy. They always moved my throne or my faldstool, which is a movable chair, and they stuck it in the middle of the aisle where I did confirmations because I always preached or spoke ex cathedra, from the throne, ex cathedra. And the reason for that is I could go back for evensong or something else to preach because I made two visitations a year to each church. But when I made my official visitation, I always preached from the throne, from the chair, ex cathedra. And that's so that I could teach. You've heard the expression, I sat at the feet of so-and-so. Well, that's where that comes from. That comes from the idea of the household, of sitting around the bishop, as you heard Father Nelson say. But you're pushing us outside of consumer Christianity. You have to understand that I graduated from seminary in 1974, and I was trained to be a semi-successful rector of a 250-member parish. I mean, that's what we were producing, you know, semi-successful rectors of small to moderate-sized churches who would maintain the systems and just give the people what they've always been wanting, which meant that, you know, by the post-communion prayer, if we got them out in an hour, they could still have their cigarette. So, I mean, it was a very bizarre period of time. It was just maintaining systems. And you're forcing us into saying that the generation that you're following has gotten it all wrong and that you want to get it right. And so you have this unique opportunity while some of us are still alive to be able to push us to make sure that we get what you need, because that's what we really thought we were being trained for.
Right.
Yeah. Hello. In history textbook that I was, you know, that I read when I was in public school growing up, talks about how the good Puritans came to America to escape from the bad English church. And it seems like that a lot of the America's spiritual DNA kind of comes from the Puritans, the Baptists, you know, and evangelicals and fundamentalists, and to some degree the Charismatics, because they broke away from a denomination and they formed their own church because they felt like the denomination was wrong in some way, and they wanted to follow God, and they were very serious about doing so. So how do we clarify or present ourselves in this country that has such a spiritual DNA, particularly to those people that are really seeking to follow Christ and to follow his word? Or am I asking the wrong question?
No, I don't. I think you're asking a good question. I've thought a lot about that myself. First, I have a lot more confidence in what holy baptism does than most of those who emphasize holy baptism so much. Because I think God really does work through holy baptism. And therefore, what happens at holy baptism, which is incorporation into Christ, according to Romans 6, that the DNA, the spiritual DNA that the Holy Spirit provides at holy baptism is greater than the theology of so many of those who practice it. Second, I would say we have to take a longer view of Christian history. That yes, America has a lot of these spiritual defects in its own spiritual formation, in its background. But but the Holy Spirit is not done yet. And, you know, in my, when I teach the history of the Anglican Way, going all the way back to Old Britain, you know, I often say, you know, where was Christianity in Old Britain at the time of Nicaea? You know, well, it was we know there were bishops from Old Britain at Nicaea. That's one of the proofs that there was a fully developed church prior to Whitby. But also after that, I mean, you had the invasions of people from Northern Europe, and eventually you had the Vikings, and it would go on for another 600 to 700 years, you know, before you get to a guy named Alfred the Great, who unifies really what we know to be as England. God's DNA, his sacramental DNA, is greater than all this other. And it will prevail, because, you know, a day to him is 1,000 years. So keep the long view.
One of the things that I like to say to people who live in an instantaneous society, which I will reinforce just a moment, what happened is there was a person who put something out, are there any Orthodox bishops left? And then he put all the points. And so on the second day, he said, I've not heard anything. Third day, he concluded there were no Orthodox bishops left because nobody had responded to him within 72 hours. It is the age in which we live, isn't it? I don't know about you, but, you know, checking my mailbox more than twice or three times a day in my email, can you imagine how silly I'd look if I walked outside and opened up the mailbox 15, 20 times a day? I mean, my neighbors would probably want to come over and console my wife, you know. So, but we've gotten to this obsessive, compulsive pattern of behavior about how rapidly certain things are supposed to take place. Well, here's what I like to say to people. What makes you think that you are so important? You have a right to see how all of this turns out. What makes you think you are that important? But what makes you think you are not so important that God doesn't need you right this very moment to be a part of the process? And that's the servant ministry, is that you and I have to be content to be Athanasius. That is, you and I have to be content to continue to fight the good fight and to proclaim the faith of the undivided church, even when it appears that we have not won the day. And the other thing I would just want to say to you is that a great deal of the work that I've had to do in the last few years, especially the work I've done in the Palestinian areas in the West Bank, make it clear that many Christians are fighting the wrong enemies. Many Christians are fighting themselves. And many Christians are also playing checkers. That is, I keep on looking at the checkerboards and I see players moving from one part of the checkerboard to the other. But if you add it all up, it's still the same number of people. They've just shifted over on a couple of different slots on the checkerboard. And this is exactly what Islam is hoping for. The more we can do shifting on the checkerboard as Christians and express that division, the greater Islam can come in and swoop down and take over. My burden, and I hope yours too, about what the future for Christians looks like will not be Christians, and I'm not suggesting that's come up here, arguing about the precise moment that the bread and the wine becomes the body and blood of Christ, although I think it's rather significant, obviously, and I don't want to minimize that. I do have a very strong opinion about that. But not spend so much arguing about that or precisely what we mean by baptismal generation, although I obviously have a very strong opinion about that, as much as it is trying to baptize the world and make the world into a Eucharistic community.
and then come up with it. You see what I'm saying? Is that claim and convert the world for Jesus Christ, because that's the battle we're fighting. And then we're going to be armed with the appropriate catechism so that we will have something to give to the people, because you and I are not going to be bringing in disaffected Presbyterians. Your generation, many of you, you are going to be bringing in converts from Islam. You don't believe that. Paganism, you'll be bringing people in from paganism. You'll be bringing in Wiccans. You'll be bringing in people who have been involved in the demonic. I spend time counseling people constantly dealing with the phenomenon of Santa Muerte. And most people look around and say, who the heck is Santa Muerte? I'm not going to tell you. If you don't know who Santa Muerte is, then you better find out, because that's reality.
Just to address your question head on, I want to say that I think, what Bishop Sutton was saying is that there are Christians in our culture today with birth defects. We will not do them any favors if we are not teaching the faith clearly. Because I get a lot of convert traffic through my parish, people that kind of wake up and realize that there's something wrong, but they're not quite sure what. And it's very attractive to them that I teach what I teach, because it's exciting and it fills a void, and so we've had a lot of convert traffic through. But I would say that we don't really need to be so concerned about that as we are with, first of all, and you're right, Islam and paganism. The thing I would say in addition to this is why counterculturalism is so important. One of the things that we can really set a great example on is to return to discipline when it comes to marriage. The fact that Anglicanism has no better marriage discipline than most of the evangelical churches out there is a real problem. It's a real problem, and our bishops need to solve it. So I'm just going to say that here. the other thing also is that Islam's birth rate is scary compared to a 1.8 birth rate among most Christians in the United States. And I'm not saying go out and have more babies. Please do, though. But what I am saying is that unless the church, and I said this yesterday, unless the church begins to honor family, we will not prevail against Islam. And that is the defining characteristic of Islam today, is that it honors the family in a way that no other culture out there does. And unless we stand firm in honoring the family and honoring the places of mothers and fathers and honoring it enough to tell people who've been divorced and remarried that they are not welcome to receive the Eucharist because they're in a state of sin and that they have sinned against the church by doing this, we are going to struggle, because the culture, again, redefines these things. And we have fallen into the trap. So a lot of thinking needs to be done about marriage. How do we recover it? In my own study, that's led me to a complete rejection of contraception. I'd like to talk more about that if I could at any given time, but that's where my wife and I have gone. Because we realize that unless we are procreative constantly within our marriage, and that means not only with children, but with regard to our evangelical life as a family, we will not be a light to the world. And that's a major issue, is that the family needs to be the prime evangelical unit of the church. And I will say it again, the church dishonors families in this country over and over and over again. So that needs to be something we all think about, is how do we honor families again? Because we have not done that work, and it is a shame, a real shame. The ancient church honored families. They believed that the church was that the household was something that they called in Latin the domus ecclesiae, the house church, the home church. Still in the Eastern Orthodox Church today, the kitchen table is a consecrated table. Why? so that when Father visits, he can celebrate the Eucharist on your table, if he has to. We need to have home chapels again. We need to refound this idea that the house is the church. That there is not a clear dividing line between the two. And I think our marriages will be strengthened by that. Our churches will be strengthened by it. But we do not honor the family. So just something to keep in mind.
Okay. Am I allowed to ask two questions? My first question is, would y'all consider Titus 2 a form of catechesis? Titus 2, it talks about how the older men should take care of the younger men and stuff. I was wondering, I guess to be more clear, I have heard many priests say that that is something we need to work towards in the church. I didn't know what, I understand catechesis being part, more familial. I didn't know if it had any, if Titus 2 and what it speaks about in Titus 2, if it had any correlation to being catechetical in any form.
This is the other part about catechesis that we don't do well, and that's that we divide up the church into generations. So, for instance, we have the little kids, the not-so-little kids. We have the junior high youth. We have the senior high youth. We have the college age. We have the young singles, the young marrieds, the people in their 40s, people in their 50s. We have the retirees. We have those who are in nursing homes. And a lot of the work we need to do is in disestablishing all of those barriers between generations. For precisely that reason. One reason is that, for instance, if you're the child of a single mother, especially the son of a single mother, you can grow up in this country without having a single male influence in your life. All your teachers. I mean, it may be that the only male influence you have in your life is a coach in high school. And the church can fill that void by doing what we're really good at, which is adoption. Right? And so we need to think about means of spiritual adoption of orphan children. We also need to think about how we can break down generational barriers. So, for instance, one of the things I do in my parish is the catechesis class is for people age 11 to death. And that sounds totally weird. But here's the thing we get wrong. We think that if we have a youth group with 50 kids in it, we're doing really well. But those youth groups are only about 95%. They're only about 5% effective. So my youth group has 5 kids in it who are going to that catechesis class who are, it's got more than that, but let's say it does. And they're in an intergenerational, and I get a 95% success. I did better. Okay? I beat you. And I'll beat you every time. Why? Because the church is to embody intergenerational faithfulness. And when we segregate it, Kenda Dean, who's a thinker in this, talks about youth ministry as the one-eared Mickey Mouse. That you sort of, the one ear is the youth group, and they're in a ghetto. Right? And they never have interactions, so they never take on the culture of the church. And we've got to break down those walls, because one of the things another friend of mine says is that what you're one with, you're one too. So if it's the church that wins you to Christ, you will always be faithful to the church. But if it's something else, something extraneous, you will depart as soon as you're able. And so intergenerational catechesis is a goal. It's got to be a goal. Because maturity doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens because you look up and you say, wow, that's how you do it. You can see it with little kids in pews. That's why I keep talking about this. Little kids look up, oh, so that's how you do it.
If I may, this is fascinating for me because I'll give you an anecdote and I'll explain it. But Bishop Parsons, whom I've mentioned, has just celebrated his 90th birthday. He had already earned a doctor's degree by the time he was 29, became the dean of Nisholt House, became the sixth bishop of Quincy, wrote three books that we've republished back there. Brilliant man. Turns 90. He came to stay with us so we could rewrite one chapter he wanted to rewrite before we republished the book. So our grandson Dominic, who's five, I've mentioned before, was there. And they both decided they wanted to do the same thing. They wanted to go to the zoo. 90-year-old man wanted to go to the zoo, so did the 5-year-old boy. So my wife and I are walking around watching them having more in common with each other than you can imagine. Now, that's the anecdote. Now let's look at the reality. What is the size of a world for a 4-year-old? What is the size of a world for a 90-year-old? What are the responsibilities? Think about that for a moment, that for a 4-year-old, their world is maybe their room, and they are already in the process of acquiring some things, but it's a relatively small space, so that if somebody moves something in the room, they might know it. A 90-year-old has been reduced in terms of the size of where he lives to a room, has already gotten rid of most everything and therefore knows what's left because he had to make some conscious decisions of what he wasn't going to get rid of. Who better to disseminate truth and to talk about such things because they have more in common? That was part of God's family plan. And I was talking to somebody the other day who told me that their parish had some people objecting to the fact that they wanted to have a family night because it discriminated against single people. Now, I mean, apart from that being stupid, there is another reality. And that is it shows that we have failed to teach that when we say family in the church, we're not talking about whether people are single, married, divorced, or widowed. We're talking about the family of God. This is the last place in the world where people who would not normally sign up for an organization and be in the same room with people wind up being in the same room. Have you ever thought about that? I mean, there's a lot of people in the church you wouldn't be going to the same club with, and you wouldn't be invited into their homes, and vice versa. But God winds up sorting this all out because these are the people he wants to have together at any given time to do the kind of work that he wants to have done at that time. So catechesis by nature is not only intergenerational, but it's because the church is intergenerational and must be. And I've spent time in Korea, and I have a friend who's bishop of Daejeon in Korea. I went over to help consecrate him a few years ago. We've been classmates in seminary. And he told me that his father was so excited when he had gray hair. He said, now I will be treated with wisdom. I'll be told that I'm wise now that I have gray hair. And he said, having lived in the United States, that means they're getting ready to ship you out. A totally different situation. In some cultures, aging means we now have wisdom. In other cultures, it means, what in the heck am I going to do with that old person? You know, where am I going to farm them out to? I better start thinking about where they can spend the residue of their life. If you want to have fun sometime to talk about how this functions, you're not going to believe this. But if you want to see how catechesis functions, although I have to say perhaps inappropriately in a vacuum, but if you want to see how it functions between in an intergenerational way, spend a few weeks in an Amish community. They have already worked it out. They've already figured out how wisdom is disseminated, how it's passed on. And when they have somebody, for example, who ages, you know what they do? They build an extra room onto the house, and it's built onto the kitchen so that they can walk into the kitchen to the table so that they can have fellowship together. Now, that's not what you expect necessarily. You don't think of them as being liturgical. But ponder that for just a moment, if you would. That's the sharing of gifts, the dissemination of information, and intergenerational learning.
Yeah, I just add, kind of building on the comments here, that I see that the model for the church is the family. And that I don't so much have a problem with subgroups within the family, because I actually think as the family grows and it gets bigger, that you will have groups within the family that organize together. But the main thing is to keep it within the family. Mm-hmm. When John writes his first epistle, he addresses to young men, to children, to different groups. Settings. Let me give you an analogy. When I was a little boy growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, we used to go to my grandmother's house every Sunday afternoon. It was a big family gathering. I mean, aunts and uncles, and we'd hang out there all afternoon at grandmother's house. Well, what would happen? I mean, it was a day where the whole family was interacting with each other, but there were times when the kids would play together, when the wives would be in the kitchen talking together, and the dads would be out in the garage and they'd be talking together. Well, was that contrary to the family? Not necessarily. Only if you broke the family apart. And what's happened in the fragmentation of our society is that the family model has been destroyed. So the key is, I believe, to keep the family as the model together, and that the family must come together and grow together and mature together, and they will if that is your model. And, of course, the church is the guide for that. So. Yeah.
Nothing to get in on. It's like a priority.
Heck, Father Lee might be preaching at Holy Communion tomorrow. Hey, you know.
All right.
Father Nelson, you made an emphatic case in your plenaries for the traditional model of catechesis in which baptism is preceded by 3 years of catechesis. I was wondering though if you could. Elaborate, and this may get theological, but elaborate on the danger of a model in which baptism precedes years of training in catechesis, which also ties into issues of the dangers of abusing baptism, say for people who are baptized and fall away from the faith, and then perhaps try to get rebaptized again. And also the implicit problem that I see with the traditional model that you presented, in which what if a person in preparation for baptism dies by asteroid from heaven? Should I finish? Okay. And what that seemed to necessitate in thinking about baptism by intent.
Okay. Baptism of intent was not just. It wasn't just a neat little, and I probably misportrayed it yesterday, or the day before, it wasn't just kind of a neat little way to solve the problem. It was a way of life. It was that your intention stood in for the sacrament while you were being prepared for it. Does that make sense? In the same way that baptism by blood, which is what they called martyred catechumens, was. But I think the larger question is, excuse me if I'm getting it wrong, but what are the dangers of baptizing early in the whole process? The only way I can illustrate this is by, I gave a very similar talk to diocesan clergy in California, and one priest in particular was very adamant that people be baptized as early as possible. And I just simply stood there and I had a little Dr. Phil moment with him and I said, how's that working for you? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, where are they? And he walked away pretty quickly because he didn't know. I know where the people are who I've baptized. Because they've been firmly established in the community and the family of the church. The catechumenate is the way of establishing people in the family of the church prior to their being established in the family of God. Does that make sense? I hope that's not exactly a clean theological way of doing it, but I would say that catechesis as a practice does not disregard the social relationships between people. It's actually very intentional about it. But I would also say that because we're so confused, we believe that conversion happens in a flash. So why shouldn't the sign of conversion, and that's not a good way of putting it either, but baptism, happen in a flash? But we should know that conversion doesn't happen in a flash. It takes a long time. And so I advocate for a year of catechesis at least before baptism. And in fact, what I often do is I say, I don't think you're ready yet. I think you need to spend more time waiting. It's a very pastoral question for a priest to be answering. But I do think, and I will argue for, that being hasty in baptism doesn't do anybody any favors. Because a lot of Americans' experience of faith is, I gave my heart to Jesus when I was 4, I did it again when I was 7, I did it again when I was 13, and then I got involved, I backslid, and then I did it again when I was 18, and I fell away from Christ when I was in college, and then I got married and had kids and I went back. The scriptures speak of this as re-crucifying Christ. I think the better way is to just be intentional about how we do this. We don't make investments in people. I think the kind of language that says, oh, do it immediately or do it as fast as possible, is literally laziness, first of all. It says, I'm not willing to put in the time, and I'm not willing to invest time in you. But clergy need to be freed up to be able to make that investment. The people need to be freed up to make that investment. We just aren't doing it. But the fruit of it is so wonderful that it fires me up every day. I mean, I'm preparing for this next round of catechesis, and I know that there are going to be people there that I've never even met before, that are just going to wander through the door because God called them there. There's no other explanation for it. And that I'm going to get to invest in 2 or 3 people this year in a very heavy way. I'm going to have them over for dinner once a month at least. I'm going to take them out for lunch. I'm going to go to their office. I'm going to meet them there. I'm going to get myself in their lives. And the end game of it is that they're going to experience conversion. But we don't invest in people. And then we explain it away as kind of this, well, let's let baptism do its job. There's a cooperation that's necessary on the part of the church. I think we have to begin to stress that. Does that make sense? Sure. Well, think about it. Think about infant baptism. I get this all the time. Grandparents are freaked out because their pagan children just had a baby, and they want to have that baby baptized. Grandparents do. And you know what my answer is now? Bring your kids here and let me evangelize them, since you're unwilling to do it. And then we'll talk. Well, I couldn't do that. Well, then there's no reason to baptize the baby. Let God do it. Because if we're not willing to do the work as families and as the church in the life of those whom we baptized even afterwards, then what are we doing? We have all this, you know, this commitment that we make to those whom we're baptizing. The church makes a commitment. And if it's not culturally in the parish the way that it should be, it will never happen. But again, this is about building a culture. The catechumen, it's a culture. It's a culture of investment in people's lives. Just like a farmer takes a lot of time on that one little seed, you know, he waters it, he fertilizes it. This is the way of cultivating the worship of God in the church. It is a lot of work. But I think we've let ourselves be deluded into thinking that putting on programs is a good stand-in for that, and it just isn't. So keep that in mind, too. Parish churches put on a whole lot of programs, but they don't do this essential task And I think we need to strip it down, because the research shows us actually that churches that have more programs have less growth, and churches that have fewer programs have more growth. Why? Because that's the way it works, you know.
Okay, I think we're probably at a good stopping point.
I think we take this up to give a round of applause to our plenary speakers for the great teaching this week.